Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately today Kathleen cannot be with us. So I have been given the honour to interview John Major Jenkins all by myself today. John, welcome to The Spirit Revolution.
Hi Philip, it's good to be talking with you again.
Yes, John, you and I, we went back a few years when we saw each other in a beautiful posh five-star hotel bar in Amsterdam, where you were, the first time I came across your research, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, and all of your research on 2012. And since then, really, the 2012 phenomenon has taken off, and you have had an awful lot of fire thrown at you for, as these things go, for probably stumbling upon the truth of the 2012 phenomenon. So it's been a roller coaster ride for, I think, an awful lot of people. A lot of people have become exposed to the 2012 phenomenon. And with the movie of last year, the 2012 phenomenon definitely has reached, I think, apocalyptic proportions, in the sense that an awful lot of people don't really know what we are supposed to be thinking. And a few weeks ago, we had Jeff Stray, a very good friend of yourself and myself, on the show, and he kind of gave us a bit of an overview as to what the 2012 phenomenon really is and what the pitfalls are and what we should be looking out for. But you have really focused so much attention on the 2012 aspect within the Mayan calendar. You have really, in my opinion, cracked the Mayan code, the 2012 code. So briefly, before we move on to an interpretation and the various layers of your finding, could you briefly just explain what you discovered about the date of 2012 and the Mayan mythology?
Sure, yeah. Well, my approach for some 25 years now has always been to get to the heart of what the ancient Maya themselves believed and thought about 2012. So my work has been engaged in a reconstruction of lost aspects of ancient Maya cosmology and religious belief. So what I hit upon in the early 90s is that in investigating the 2012 question is that 2012 is indeed an intentional artifact of the ancient calendar. It falls on a solstice, and that was one vector for me which led me in that direction. But then I investigated further into the site of Izapa. Izapa is a pre-classic site in southern Mexico, and it's acknowledged as being involved in the formulation of this 2012 calendar over 2,000 years ago. And my investigation of that site, which it makes sense, right? Let's go look at the site that was involved in the formulation of this 2012 calendar. Nobody else had done that before. So,
and John, another example of somebody who has left the armchair research and goes into the world and comes up and does things which really the academics are unable to do.
Exactly, exactly. The academics, it must be said, were not even looking at 2012. They had barely glanced at it. There were a few bits and pieces here and there. But by the late 90s, I had published my book, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, as you mentioned. And in that book, I provided all of the research and documentation by which we could understand that why the Maya picked this date, and it has to do with astronomy, and what they believed about it. And in a nutshell, what they believed about it is that it has to do with transformation and renewal that is embedded into their belief about cyclic time and their ceremonies for period endings. And so there was no evidence that the Maya predicted doomsday or some kind of apocalyptic catastrophe in 2012. That has been the 2012 phenomenon as it's been filtered through the marketplace and Hollywood movies and so on.
It really was something that, before you made your discoveries, because before everybody even know and really began to look at 2012, people had already come up with this typical millennial fear-mongering, which really is very typical, I think, of a Western mindset. So when you came across what 2012 really was, the calendrical aspects, these aspects of renewal, should we just take them symbolically? Is this just something which was of interest to them to write about? Or is there really something phenomenal, and if not phenomenally beautiful, at the core of this mystery?
I think that the Maya insight into time cycles and human spirituality and consciousness awakening and consciousness forgetting, these two poles of the human journey on planet Earth, I think that the Maya actually have an insight into the nature of consciousness, which is superior to the linear time frame that is the default assumption of Western science and Western Judeo-Christian tradition. You know, we're basically looking at two different paradigms of time, and I think that the cyclic view of time is more consistent with how time really unfolds in nature. Cycles are all around us in nature, and there's periods of increase and periods of decrease. And so I think that the Maya idea that cycle endings are times of transformation and renewal, and all the teachings that go with that in the Maya creation mythology, which is one of the two parts that I've been interested in elucidating in my work, the spiritual teachings, I think, are part of a grand perennial philosophy, you might say, something that is touched upon at the core of all of the world's great religious traditions, but has often been obscured or eclipsed by the obsessions of fundamentalist perspectives, which seem to really be on the rise today in exoteric dogmatic religion.
Why is that? I mean, why is there this rise? And is that actually part of the cycle as the Mayans were describing it, or are the two just unrelated or coincidental?
No, I think it's really part of the cycles of time that humanity goes through, and the Maya had a certain insight into that, but it's also shared by, for example, Oriental philosophies in Hinduism. You have the insight that humanity goes from, for example, it's the model of the world ages, basically. And we are at a time when consciousness is stuck to the surface of reality. Consciousness has lost its connection with the transcendent, with the deeper essence that underlies manifest reality. And so you get religious expressions that have lost their own contact with their own esoteric dimension. And so then religions are, and political discourse and everything else in the world is just stuck to the surface and can't see the deeper unifying threads that underlie everything. And that is diagnostic of what the Hindus would call Kali Yuga, the Dark Ages, the age in which the spiritual connection has been lost and everything is focused on materialism.
Religion with all the dogma but with none of the spirituality, which is, of course, something which the Spirit Revolution is focusing on quite on a number of occasions on.
Exactly.
Now, bringing it back, and we'll kind of probably be going to jump from culture to culture at some point, but there you are, we are in Izapa, in Mexico. They make this discovery, and as you've pointed out in your book, the Mayans weren't born with this knowledge. They seem to have developed this understanding of the nature of the universe. So how is it, did they know that there was something before this era began, like which they began in 3114, if I'm not mistaken, but they weren't around? How did they find out? How did they grasp this knowledge, not merely the astronomical part of it, but also this cyclical nature and the intensity of decline and ascent of civilizations and culture?
Well, setting aside the astronomical science for the moment, your question really brings up how the Maya understand reality and cycles of time and so on. Well, it basically comes from observing nature. And one of those components is the sky, of course, so that leads to astronomical knowledge. But looking around them in nature, the cycles of plant growth and human growth and animals and the cycles of the seasons, all of these things fed into and influenced their philosophy of time and their philosophy of reality and nature. And it's really something that is not so abstracted from the immediacy of felt experience of living on this planet, of being, you know, going through the seasons and going through your own human life cycle from birth to increase to decline to death. You know, all of these things are wrapped together in the same package, and the Maya really understood that, and they saw that affirmed all around them in nature all the time.
And when they were looking around, they were looking at the sky, and this is where very much John Major Jenkins has done the contribution. What they saw when looking at the sky, they saw this galactic alignment, as you've called it. Can you briefly explain in astronomical and mythological terms what that precisely is?
Sure. And this is where the two things are really integrated in Maya thought and also in my work. I've tried to not forsake one for the other, and I've sort of come under fire, as you've said, for you know, refusing to, like, not talk about the spiritual teachings embedded in this 2012 cosmology. So you have the astronomical component, and the Maya were very interested in the cycles in the sky, and this galactic alignment is basically defined as the alignment of the December solstice sun with a feature that was important to the Maya called the dark rift in the Milky Way. The dark rift is a feature that's visible to the naked eye. It's caused by interstellar dust that runs along the midplane of the galaxy. And this alignment to the dark rift is caused by an Earth phenomenon called the precession of the equinoxes. Precession is caused by the slow wobble of the Earth on its axis, and one complete wobble takes some 26,000 years. Now, the Maya astronomers and stargazers, according to my reconstruction work, some 2,200 years ago, were looking at these shifting processes in the sky. And like the Greek astronomer Hipparchus, they only needed about 150 years of observational star data to realize that the stars were shifting and that the sun itself was moving very slowly towards the bright band of the Milky Way. So they realized, and this is where the mythology comes into play, because it became a very potent idea for them that a future alignment between the December solstice sun, the position of the December solstice sun, which is shifting with precession, the future alignment between the December solstice sun and the bright band of the Milky Way and the dark rift feature that lies along that midplane was going to be very, very potent mythologically, and I believe that they embedded it into their creation mythology. They saw it as the future rebirth of the solar lord, who in the Maya creation myth is the father of the hero twins named One Hunapu. So you have the more technical aspect of figuring out how the Maya did this as scientists and astronomers, it's not impossible for them to have done it. As I mentioned, we have the comparative example of Hipparchus, who also didn't have telescopes and was also doing his work about the same time as the early Maya were doing their work at Azapa. But then you have then this idea that they fixed the end date of their 13 Bakhtun cycle, December 21st, the solstice of 2012, to this alignment. So there's a whole host of other questions that comes up with this that we could explore, or people could go to my website to answer their questions. But the evidence for this comes from the fact that this alignment image, the alignment of the sun and the dark rift, is embedded into all kinds of Maya institutions, from the sacred ball game to the creation myth to the symbolism of king-making rites. And so that's really the proof of the pudding.
So we're confronted with a situation, if you want, whereby the Mayas see this event in the sky. Now, are we supposed to be interpreting this as an astronomical phenomenon, or is there, you think, actually something which is emanating from this center of the galaxy towards us that actually has or is causing these spiritual changes on Earth?
This is an interesting question, and I have explored this in several of my books. The idea or the question as to whether this solstice galaxy alignment has empirical effects in some kind of scientific sense, there's not an answer to that yet. Scientists simply haven't looked at it very closely. There's been a lot of knee-jerk dismissals by sort of under-informed astronomers and astrophysicists, but I think it's an open question at this point. But at the same time, I don't think it's critical at all for understanding what the ancient Maya themselves believed. So my work has always been oriented towards understanding how the Maya thought about 2012 and why they picked 2012 to end this 13 Bakhtun cycle. And on another level, too, I think that maybe we shouldn't be so fixated to our own culture's desire to find some kind of absolute causal empirical scientific evidence or proof for something to be true, you might say. This gets into the more philosophical question of the perennial philosophy that I talk about in my book, The 2012 Story, that recognizes a non-dual basis to reality, that the sky and the earth are interrelated, the spiritual domain and the material domain are unfolding in tandem, you might say, but they're not necessarily causally related. You know, one doesn't have to affect the other or vice versa. It's really a situation of mutual unfolding between realms. And I think that for the Maya, they saw this thing happening in the sky, and they didn't really think about it in causal terms. They immediately went to the more mythopoetic dimension, where they believed that this alignment in the future would signify a time of unification of Father Sun and Mother Galaxy. But it's not a question of something definitively happening or causing something to happen or happening to us in some kind of empirical way, because in the Maya teaching, even though this alignment out there is happening in some kind of real sense, it still takes human beings doing something to open up to the possibility of transformation and renewal. That's why there's a sort of a package deal in the spiritual teachings for 2012 as we see it in the Maya creation myth, and it's the idea that sacrifice is necessary in order to successfully facilitate transformation and renewal. And that's where we plug right into the deepest spiritual teachings of the Maya creation myth, as well as the deepest spiritual teachings in the perennial philosophy in all of the world's great spiritual traditions.
Absolutely. And speaking somewhat for Kathleen here, in her novel, specifically The Book of Love, and her upcoming The Poet Prince, there is this idea and this expression that martyrs were always required to bring about change. And specifically in The Poet Prince, where she delves into the entire Renaissance era, the idea and the hope is that there is going to be a time when no more martyrs are needed to bring about change. As you said, it's this martyrdomship is at the core of Christianity with the sacrifice of Jesus. When we're moving into a Mayan time set, and when we're moving into 2012, what do you see happening specifically within Central America? Is there a sincere danger that they are going to look for a martyr, or is actually something else going on there on a sociological or economical or political level?
That's a really interesting question and very complicated, I think, in terms of the political landscape, and heartened by observing over my many years relationship with living and working with my people in Central America, that there seems to be a kind of renaissance going on, a Maya renaissance. And I follow upon the work of an ethnic Maya scholar named Victor Montejo in this, who wrote an amazing book called Maya Intellectual Renaissance. And, of course, in the 80s, there were death squads. Over 400 villages wiped off the map to make room for foreign agricultural investment interests in the highlands, beautiful, lush agricultural areas. And since then, of course, we've had amazing Maya leaders come out, like Rigoberta Menchú, speaking out against this kind of thing. And more recently, we have Maya spiritual guides and calendar priests and leaders becoming aware that this 2012 thing is looming on the horizon. Now, it's a kind of a tricky and complicated thing, because the fact is that the long count calendar that gives us the 2012 date fell into disuse centuries ago and was forgotten by the Maya. I mean, they still preserve the 260-day sacred calendar, and they still preserve the rites and ceremonies that are performed at smaller period endings in the calendar, which do involve the values of sacrifice, transformation, and renewal. So they preserve the essential spiritual understanding of period endings, which would apply to 2012, but they lost the details of the long count. But they're being reintroduced to it, and I think that there's very progressive Maya leaders and ceremonial activists that are very interested in this 2012 phenomenon. And I think that on many different levels, it has to do with forging alliances and relationships and partnerships with the other, you might say. On one level, there can be a dance and a relationship and a partnership between male and female. Of course, that's something that we're all sort of engaged with in our own human lives and so on. But this integration of opposites, I think, can be happening on a much larger level. in terms of the indigenous mind relating to the Western colonial mindset, which is still very much an issue and problem, perhaps especially in the Americas, and indigenous people around the world who I think preserve an understanding of the importance of being connected into the essence, of seeing the essence that underlies the changing forms of manifest material reality. See, that's where we can have an integrated consciousness, because Western consciousness has been obsessed with the surface, and in the indigenous consciousness is in touch with the essence. So I think we have the opportunity for an integration of the opposites so that we can see the big picture. We can open up to the big picture and have a reintegrated worldview. And in a sense, that is, in a sense, the Maya prophecy, you might say, for 2012, that there can be this awakening to a big spiritual integrated picture for human life on Earth.
And when you're talking about the integration and the male and the female, again, Kathleen and I, when we were looking into specifically the 2012 phenomenon, it almost appeared that there were no women in Mayan culture. We said that, you know, women were exported together with the Spanish to the Mayan civilization, because when you read, not in your books, but like the books which, as you're pointing out, pretty much use the 2012 phenomenon as an intellectual exercise rather than really looking at what is going on at the heart of the Mayan heartland, that it seems to be void of women. It seems to be a succession of men who never married. How, when you come across, when you go into the Mayan heartland, what is the relationship? What is the cooperation between men and women there? Is there a very active, or is there pretty much also what one would call a Western mindset present there?
Well, what I found and what I observe in Maya households and in Maya culture, traditional Maya culture, is that there are distinct roles that men and women have. But I guess I'd like to say ideally, but I think also very often in practice, there's equal power in those roles. The women's roles tend to be sort of more aligned with the underlying essence, which can seem to be sort of more like back in the shadows somewhere, not really overtly recognized. But it has equal power in comparison to the men's roles that are more actively oriented towards going out into the fields and going out into the world and the markets and that kind of thing. So in the contemporary Maya traditional culture, you do really have sort of an integrated male-female relationship. I guess that is the ideal, and I'm sure it's not happening all the time. But going back to the Maya classic period, we have many examples of women playing very significant roles in the political intrigues that were going on in various war campaigns and kingdoms from Palenque and Yaxchilan. And so women actually did play very important roles, I think, because they were seen to have a special, almost priestly or priestess kind of role in the rites of sacrifice. There really is something interesting going on there with all of that.
So what kind of roles were they performing when you say they were performing some roles in the rites of sacrifice?
Yeah. This operated in the realm of the human priestess or woman or wife of the king, you might say, performing in a specific role in a sacrifice rite that was intended to ensure renewal of the kingdom or ensure the place of her husband in the chain of kingly succession, you might say. But she was always performing in her human form or embodying the role of a supernatural female deity. And there's an interesting book by translator Dennis Tedlock that just came out. It's called 2,000 Years of Mayan Literature, and it's actually really amazing because he details at Palenque and Yaxchilan and other Maya sites how the rites were performed at certain astrologically propitious moments. Namely, many times when the moon was aligning with the dark rift in the Milky Way, or other planets were aligned with the dark rift in the Milky Way. So this is recent evidence that actually affirms the perspectives that I've put on the table many years ago with the importance of the dark rift in the Milky Way as a kind of a female birthplace. In my views on this, as I've seen at Azapa, the dark rift is sort of like the rebirth place of the Milky Way Great Mother Goddess. And it seems to be utilized time and time again by the Maya as a place of renewal and a place connected to sacrifice and renewal rites that were often performed by women, often the wives of Maya kings.
So what was this kind of sacrifice that the king or members of the royal family, if you want, had to endure? Is it literally their heads being chopped off and the kind of dramatic scenes which we've all seen in movies such as Apocalypto? Or was it a different kind of sacrifice?
There were literal types of blood sacrifice rites that were performed. And this is because in the spiritual teaching, you know, in order to successfully facilitate transformation and renewal, you have to be engaged in offering and sacrificing that which is essential to your being. In a more spiritual interpretation, metaphorical interpretation that I've tried to emphasize because I think these teachings are universally valid and important, if we go to the more universal level with this, we can say that it's necessary to sacrifice one's attachment to illusions, the illusions that are keeping one's consciousness stuck to a plane of limitation. I think this was ultimately the thrust of the sacrifice rites that were performed by the Maya, but in fact, the Maya didn't necessarily see a distinction between literal ceremonial act and the underlying metaphorical intention. So what's really interesting is that, and this is something that I brought out in my recent book, is that you have death dates of Maya kings that often strangely correspond to alignments to the dark rift in the Milky Way. In fact, Jupiter was seen to be a royal planet, you might say, a planet that was connected to kingship. The great king of Copan, Washaklahun Ubakahwil, his name is 18 Rabbit, and in the mid-8th century, he was sacrificed in a sort of a strange sort of intentional ceremony by the leader of Carigua on May 1st of 738 AD, and on that day, Jupiter was aligned with the Dark Rift. So his head was cut off, he was sacrificed, he was decapitated in a ceremonial rite, but it's almost as if he willingly went to that sacrifice in a similar way that we have in the Christian tradition, Jesus willingly going to the cross. There's some kind of higher principle involved in the principle of self-sacrifice, and it can be literally played out as a ceremonial rite.
You've mentioned just Jupiter there. The planet Venus is also very important. In Western traditions, Venus has got a very feminine aspect. Is that the same in the Mayan civilization? Because I believe that in the Mayan civilization, it seems to have been more linked with Quetzalcoatl, which is a male deity.
Yeah, you're right on that. It actually has two aspects. In the best-known mythology around Venus, you have Quetzalcoatl and his dark twin brother Tezcatlipoca, who some believe corresponds to Venus in its evening star phase. And in other contexts, Tezcatlipoca seems to be connected to the polar region, the pole star. So you have different sort of threads going on in this, but because Venus rises as morning star, it's tied to a mythology of rebirth and renewal.
And when we're touching upon this aspect of twin aspects, what comes to my mind is the aspect of twin souls. You've identified Quetzalcoatl and his twin aspects. You've got in cultures like ancient Egypt, Osiris and Isis, when we are looking into the material which Kathleen writes about in her novels, specifically The Poet Prince, which is coming up, you will find lots of information there about twin souls. This twin soul phenomenon is part and parcel of what you've described as the perennial philosophy, and you've been trying to trace this understanding or this awareness of galactic alignment across the world, including in a book called Galactic Alignment. Mm-hmm. What were your findings? Because the book is a few years old, so where are we there with trying to identify this knowledge of the galactic alignment, as well as whether there really is across the world this global consciousness, this global understanding of how wisdom should be attained?
Well, yeah, the Galactic Alignment book came out in 2002, and it was the natural follow-up to My Cosmogenesis 2012, because clearly if the Maya had hit upon this idea of some kind of transformative event when the solstice lines up with the galaxy, that kind of thing, it could be within the realm of possibility for other cultures. I think I did find a lot of suggestive evidence that other ancient cultures were aware of precession, certainly, and aware of these anchor points for the alignment, which on one level is the dark rift in the Milky Way, but co-spatial to that is the cross formed by the Milky Way and the ecliptic. The ecliptic is the path followed by the sun, moon, and planets, and it crosses over the Milky Way right there at the southern terminus of the dark rift. And the cross of the Milky Way and the ecliptic was known to the Neoplatonic philosophers like Macrobius, who in the late 5th century had talked about it as a reference point for the gate of ascent back into the realm of the Empyrean, the unmanifest realm of the first intelligence, that kind of thing. And of course there's another cross on the other side of the sky in the region of Gemini, and this was the gate of descent into incarnation, according to some of the Gnostic and Neoplatonic beliefs. So there are some strange echoes of this that can be traced in Homer's Odyssey book and up through the Neoplatonic philosopher Porphyry, even as late into the mythology of William Blake in England, you know, embraces some of these ideas that he got from Swedenborg and so on. So I think there's an interesting thread that can be traced, almost like an underground stream going back, I believe, to Egypt and probably further back into the Vedic teachings of ancient India, in which there probably was a knowledge of these astronomical processes. Now, in terms of the teachings involving the twins, I think this gets into something that can be connected to astronomy, but doesn't necessarily have to be. It's the idea that the two opposite forces need to work together in order to bring about the awakening or the transcendental opening into an awareness of our connection to the source consciousness. This is talked about by philosophers like Ananda Kumaraswamy, perennial philosophers like René Guénon and others. Of course, it's well known. The transcendence of opposites is necessary. The working together of the dual forces are essential for moving up to the next level of spiritual growth.
And tying it back to where we are in the world, not just with the Mayans, but also for the Western mindset, you've already been identifying that really the Mayan have got a lot to give to the Western world, a lot of understanding, a lot of wisdom. What do you, if you were to go to, say, a checklist, if you want, of what a Mayan Renaissance is contributing to the world as a whole, which is almost, I think, the antidote to this doomsaying about how the world is going to end in 2012. What are really the key aspects? What time and again is happening? What do we see? What should we know? What should we observe as to what this integration of duality needs to happen or is happening?
Yeah, I think that the modern Maya preserve the ceremonial rites and the ability to perform and facilitate the ceremonial rites that are necessary for facilitating transformation and renewal. For Westerners who are often divorced from having a deep, direct, reverential experience of this kind of thing, to go and to experience a living tradition that is still performing period-ending rites that are intended to help world renewal, you might say, it can be a very, very powerful thing. I think it is the thing that has been lost in Western religions and in Western tradition generally. I mean, we have practically no rites of renewal it's associated with ancient pagan superstitions or something like that. The best thing that people do in spring in terms of renewal is clean out their garage, perhaps, you know. We have these very indirect sort of understandings of the importance of renewal, but in fact in Western culture we deny death and renewal. The two things are connected together, really. The death of the old, the death of that which no longer works, the sacrificing of the illusions that no longer really work, the values of the previous cycle, you might say. You know, these things don't come into play in Western culture. In fact, we deny the full cycle. You know, we have a cult of youth. We deny death. We try to make our bodies live forever through surgeries and surface procedures and so on. So I think that's what's kind of leading Western civilization to the brink of apocalypse, because we deny the full cycle and we're unwilling to sacrifice the stuff that we hold on to recognize that that stuff doesn't serve us anymore, and that in clinging to those illusions, it's leading us less elegantly to a type of unavoidable impasse.
And tying that concept of rejuvenation into something which, again, speaking on behalf of Kathleen here, in The Poet Prince, there is this wonderful discovery which she's made about how the Botticelli, the very famous Botticelli painting, is actually originally was called The Time Returns. It has to do with this concept of eternal spring. Spring, of course, which is all about this renewal, this wonderful beauty which is being reborn and which is both eternal but also returns. And when we kind of delve into that slightly more, I think that the next question then is, okay, the Western mindset is stuck in this linear time. We try to buy our heaven, sometimes literally in some traditions, in some religions. How do we shift this? Because we can go to the Mayan heartland and get in contact with these people, but it's, first of all, it cannot accommodate the millions of people who really should go there, and it's still quite a touristy enterprise. So how do we, or what should we do in the Western world to bring about this change? Do we just sit back and let the Mayans explain it to us, or what is needed for us?
Yeah, that's an interesting sort of series of scenarios there. I think that the key thing is that the Maya insight into spiritual awakening is something that can be found in whatever tradition one seems to resonate with. It's really a question of sort of doing the work and going more deeply into investigating what the roots of one's mind and heart, and, you know, investigating one's own soul relationships with other people, and sort of uncovering and peeling back the layers of misconception and illusion. So it's almost like a process of deepening gnosis, you know, gnosis, getting in touch with that deep understanding and insight, a kind of, it's basically an awakening process. And I think that term, awakening, is really a key to this. And that is sort of what the shift has to be about. We have to sort of change our frameworks, our terminology, because in a lot of the discourse around 2012 and in the New Age movement and other philosophical ideas, there's this emphasis on spiritual evolution or something. It's like the term evolution has been co-opted to talk about spirituality. And to me, if we are moving into a more intimate relationship with our eternal and infinite source, well, we can't evolve the eternal infinite source. You know, that's already out there somewhere. We've just lost contact with it. We have to awaken to it. And I think that it might seem like a minor sort of semantic point or something, but I think it does indicate an important way that we can think about these processes that are going on. You know, it's really a process of deepening gnosis and awakening to something that's already there inside of us.
And definitely when you look at how quickly some of the changes have been happening in the world over the past few years, it is truly astonishing. It was 1989 when Berlin Wall fell, when really the world was divided in two big parts, and they became one, and they were trying to work together. And when we, as you were saying, it was also the 1980s when the Western mindset was still very much imperialistic to what was happening in Central America, and how you see that actually largely due to terrorist activities, whereby the terrorists in the Mayan heartland felt that their people needed to waken up to their own sense of being, that they begin to get into a mindset that they were actually a valued member of society, and that they had to offer something to the world as much as, if not more, than the people who they had been oppressed for decades, in fact centuries. So you return on a very frequent basis to the Mayan heartland, and you see a society which is being reborn. Where is that society heading? Is it, for example, dangerous to think that it will keep going in the right direction, and that it might actually, you know, be confronted with the same pitfalls of Western materialistic society? Where is the Mayan heartland heading?
Well, the Mayan heartland is really comprised of a civilization that wasn't really spiritually conquered. It's remained in touch with its deep roots. It's embraced certain surface features that resemble Christianity, and there's been a bit of a syncretic process of merging different things, but the essential thing is there. And the tricky thing is here that any civilization has many different levels or layers going on inside of it. And one of those layers is the deeper consciousness, which some of the members of that civilization will embrace and be able to put into practice. You know, the people of the civilization, whether it's the Mayan civilization or European or American or whatever you want to call it, or the entire Earth, you know, there's going to be a percentage of people that are able to embrace and live in the immediate felt knowledge that there is an underlying unity to reality and to human life. But at the same time, on a different level, a more surface level of a culture or a civilization or all of planet Earth, you're going to have the vicissitudes of political wars and endless disagreements, and it's very, very difficult for that layer to be pierced by a renaissance that is impelled by sort of an eruption, as if from below, of a deeper integrating knowledge. It's almost like a forbidden thing, you know, for the exoteric, dogmatic, surface disputes that are always happening somewhere on the planet to really be influenced by a deeper integrating knowledge of essence. I think that it does happen at times. You know, it's the times that we look to in our history, our histories, as being times of renaissance. You know, like the Enlightenment period was influenced by the profound ancient Greek teachings coming through in new translations in the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries, and how that influenced a renaissance of European consciousness being in touch with this deeper sort of Platonic and Neoplatonic esoteric stream of wisdom from the ancient Greek thinkers. And I think that the modern Maya world, we could be faced with a similar situation in which the perennial wisdom teachings that have been preserved among the Maya can burst forth and influence the stiff and stuck values and paradigms of Western civilization. And we might see a kind of a renaissance that would affect, for a time perhaps, the political power structure of the planet. But we've got, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, the whole planet Earth doesn't have to be embraced with peace and love or something like that. I'm not sure, because it's almost like a multidimensional ecology of souls who are operating on different frequencies. It's almost unrealistic to think that that could happen. But what could be heartening in all of this is that what really matters is the deeper essential unity that is there, and that people can awaken to that deeper essential unity, whether they're, you know, sitting in an ashram in California or you know, sitting in a battlefield in Afghanistan. You know, it's kind of a paradox, but I think that it's a realistic position to take, you know, that, you know, we have these different planes of reality, but we choose where we want to live in terms of our consciousness.
And definitely when we're talking about Renaissance, the slogan is always the time returns. When you started on this voyage of discovery 2 decades ago, were you aware of the fact that you were going to find these perennial truths, or really have the 2 decades in which you have been delving into the 2012 story, have they been a voyage of discovery for you? What is the 2012 phenomenon for John Major Jenkins personally?
Yeah, it has been a deepening process for me, and before I get into that, I just want to say one more thing about the previous question, because this is sort of where my new book ends up. It ends up with the dire situation in the political landscape of the world and how we do need social activism. But the essential thing that I want to try to get across to people is that that engaged outward social activism has to be informed by the inner work that a person is doing. In other words, we can't just become sort of environmental terrorists doing actions on, you know, transnational corporations or something. The transformation of the world needs to come out from within, almost as if on a grassroots level. In other words, we will be effective in the transformation of the outer world to the extent that we're doing the inner work. And I guess that's what I was trying to get to in my response to your previous question. Now, yeah, you know, it's been really an incredible journey, Philip. That, I mean, I look back, I'm sort of at this time of reassessing, you know, this whole journey I've been on from 25 years ago when I first went to Guatemala, and how amazing that first trip was, and then returning to Guatemala many times over the years, living and working with the Maya, and I think that my intention has always been to be in service to the truth, you might say, and on a sort of a academic or technical level, again, you know, always wanting to keep my focus on reconstructing what the ancient Maya really thought about this 2012 thing and what they believed. The 2012 thing actually is sort of, I'm sort of trying to get past it in a sense. It has become the focus of my work. I never really intended my work to be corresponding to the imminent appearance of this date. You know, we're getting very close to it now. That never was a strategy that, oh, I'm gonna write about a topic that's gonna be really a hot topic in the marketplace or something like that. No, I was just, to me, 20 years ago, when I first stumbled upon this 2012 thing, it was perplexing and baffling that nobody was really talking about it, especially in some kind of rigorous academic sense. So for me, it's been a process of deepening engagement with, you know, putting this work out there. I've been dealing with many different aspects of it, from the craziness in the media to endless sort of ridiculous critiques that are thrown at me by people that seem to have a bone to pick with me for some reason. A lot of it's really antagonistic and isn't really engaging in good Socratic debate, you know, on the points of the evidence and so on. It becomes really sort of a time-wasting sort of thing. But I've launched some new websites in order to try to you know, convey with clarity what's going on in this area of debate around my 2012 alignment theory. And so I've launched a new website called update2012.com, which contains all of the links to academic critiques by scholars of my work. You know, I'm transparent in sharing that, but I respond to it as well, because I think people need to have that information. I think what's most heartening is that there's this new approach to 2012 by scholars through this dated monument. This Tortuguero Monument 6 contains a 2012 date. And that really only came into popular awareness about four years ago, in 2006. And so now, whereas scholars previous to that said, oh, well, you know, there's nothing to say about 2012 because there's no inscriptions that have 2012 date in it, now scholars are really talking about it. And I've actually had a bit of a breakthrough in presenting my paper to the Society for American Archaeology in St. Louis just about 3 weeks ago, in which I talked about the astronomy in the Tortuguero Monument, sharing the work that I've done as well as the incredible work that Maya scholar Michael Grof has done to decode the astronomy on the 13 dates in this monument. And I can say in a nutshell that it's actually affirming and vindicating the astronomical theory that I put on the table 15 years ago, as well as my interpretation that the Maya thought about 2012 as a time of world renewal. And that also seems to be affirmed by the inscription connected to the 2012 date on that Tortuguero monument. So it's really an incredible time right now.
You were saying that 2012 sort of became a coincidence in your life, that it all began to take on much more focus. It became the focus of your work. Mm-hmm. Now, after 2012, are there other things you want to try and get out, other aspects of the perennial philosophy which you feel people should be aware of, or are you going to continue to be focused on the Mayan calendar?
Well, I'll always be doing, having my eye to what's emerging. You know, very, very lately, for example, there's been the recognition of another 2012 date, a date that references the cycle ending in 2012 on an inscribed brick from a site called Comalcalco, which is near Tortuguero. So there's always new developments happening. But in fact, I've been pretty active with a lot of different things in my investigations, in my life. I've got a lot of different interests, and in fact, I've got manuscripts that are basically sitting on the shelf that don't relate to Maya cosmology and calendar and the 2012 question, that explore other things, other interests. I'm working also on a group that it's a nonprofit called the Maya Conservancy, and this is something that was born out of conversations that I had with some friends in Guatemala many years ago. Jim Reed, Mary Lou Reitinger, George Ann Johnson, these people that I've been connected with, and they really got the ball rolling on this. And the Maya Conservancy now is a legitimate nonprofit group that is dedicated to education and preserving Maya sites. So this promises to have a life well beyond 2012. In fact, we're building an educational center and presentation conference center on some land right near the site of Izapa. And so this promises to provide an avenue through which the modern Maya as well can teach about their traditions. In fact, this summer we have the first event sponsored by the Maya Conservancy that is happening June 19th to the 26th in Guatemala, in which we're bringing Maya indigenous spiritual guides and daykeepers together to do ceremonies at the sites, along with a small group of participants, 16 to 18 people. We still have actually some two or three spots for this trip coming up in June. People can go to one of my websites to check that out. And so there's a lot of things going on. I've got a lot of different interests that I continue to pursue. And I am sort of concerned that, you know, probably not a lot of people are going to care about anything related to 2012 after 2012, especially in the crazy marketplace and the media areas. But it doesn't really matter to me. I'm just going to continue doing the research and uncovering lost aspects of Maya cosmology, as I've been doing for many years now.
And that's what makes you a true spirit revolutionary. You have identified yourself specifically saying that, you know, you will never let go of the spiritual dimension, because it really is part and parcel of what this is all about. And I guess we share a similar hope that, as this program is called The Spirit Revolution, that in the next years this drive will not just stop in 2012, but that people will embrace change and continue to embrace change on their path to a better world. So, John, Your website we will put in once again on our website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. Thank you for a very interesting interview, and I'm sure that our listeners have been enthralled by everything you have to say. You have written several books, Mayan Cosmogenesis 2012, Galactic Alignment, and the most recent, The 2012 Story. I thank you for being on our show. And this was another edition of The Spirit Revolution. On behalf of Kathleen and myself, see you next week, and the truth against the world.